Thank you. Welcome to this 12th panel session today in this second journey of this symposium, International Symposium on Gender Roles. There is a person who hasn't show up yet. We are waiting for him. Although, since we have to stick to the program timetable, we will already start with his permission. I will introduce the first panelist by simply saying that Darren Yutang Jin is adscribed to the University of Oxford. Thank you, Darren, for being here with us. And he's going to present Confucian role ethics, roles in contractualism, and the regional position, a new approach. Thank you very much. The floor is yours.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, John. I'm just trying to share my screen. Could you see my screen?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, actually, I just moved to Princeton, just started my postdoc. Sorry, I haven't updated my information. So hello, everyone. My name is Yutang Jin, and I'm a postdoc at Department of Politics at Princeton. The draft paper that I'm going to present today is entitled Confucian Role Ethics and Roles in Contractualism, a New Approach. So I'm kind of trying to reconcile Confucian role ethics with roles in contractualism and find a new way forward. So in this presentation, I will give you a little bit of background about like what kind of debate I'm participating in, the issue of perfectionism in Confucian political theory. And then I will turn to Confucian role ethics and discuss its contributions and limits and why Confucian role ethics needs to, you know, accommodate contractualist concerns. And third, which is a crucial part of my argument, I will apply the tricked original position to Confucian role ethics and see what kind of principles can be derived from that. And I will also attend to some objections by the end of my talk. So just a little bit background. There is a burgeoning literature in Confucian political theory. And lots of Confucian political theorists today, they are interested in, you know, they are, on the one hand, they are inspired by Confucian values and Confucian heritage and how Confucian values and habits and morals still deeply structure East Asians, their way of their ordinary life. But on the other hand, the problem is that East Asian political theorists, they also need to attend to challenges from liberalism, like especially the values of freedom, equality, and value diversity, etc. So the problem is very nicely summed up by a Confucian political theorist called Sung Mun Kim, who works in Hong Kong. And he says that, well, we are facing a perfectionist dilemma. And the dilemma is between perfectionist commitment, Confucian political theorist perfection commitment, their commitment to Confucian perfectionist values on one hand, and modern circumstances of social diversity, value pluralism, and moral disagreement. So against this spectrum, there is a kind of there is a fierce disagreement on how, you know, Confucian values can be legitimately promoted in the Confucian context. And at one side of the spectrum, there are, you know, comprehensive Confucians or traditionalist Confucians. They just they don't think there is any problem just imposing, you know, traditional Confucian values on modern East Asian citizens. And then there are moderate Confucian perfections. They say that, well, there are some perfection values in Confucianism which are universal, which are moderate, and which can be, you know, widely promoted. And public reason Confucians, they say that we need to reconcile Confucian perfectionist values with democratic participation, which means that, well, as long as, you know, perfection values, you know, go through the democratic process and they are approved by democratic citizens through that process, then there is no problem for the state to legitimately promote Confucian perfection values in East Asian societies. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there is public reason liberalism. And these public reason liberals, they say that, well, it is not legitimate to promote Confucian perfection values in the public sphere, but still Confucian values can play a very significant role in the private life of ordinary citizens. So that's the debate. And then I think that various as their, you know, normative commitments are, they have a shared premise, which is the priority of the right over the good, insofar as persons should be treated as free and equal. And I think rights take priority here because, you know, violating basic rights and liberties is tantamount to failing to recognize respect, you know, for people as free and equal. And I think there are two rotten arguments that can move us from the moral status of persons as free and equal to the priority of the right over the good. That's also where I see a kind of a gap, a difference between, you know, the earlier Ross in the theory of justice and the later Ross in public reason, in political liberalism. So the first argument is sociological. I think this is this argument can be found in the later Ross. And the idea is that, well, rights take priority because it is deeply entrenched in the background culture of the liberal societies of the West. So we start from the ground, it is a bottom-up process, and we start from, you know, the kind of basic values shared by most people in liberal societies, and we go from there. And the second point is the second approach is the original position approach. So the basic idea is that we need to appeal to the original position as an initial justification necessary for this kind of approach can be appropriated by Confucians. And so I make a distinction between the two-stage model and one-process model. And for the public reason liberalism, that's the one-process model. You need to justify, you know, perfection values or whatever values that state is trying to promote to ordinary citizens every time. But for the two-stage model, so you just need to justify those policies in the original position. And then at second stage, you will have some very, kind of universal principles of justice in place. So just to clarify, I'm talking about Ross contractualism, not, very famous strand of contractualism associated with Scanlon, because I'm not trying to, you know, challenge Confucian ethics. I'm just trying to see how, you know, the contractualist approach can be accommodated in the context of Confucianism. And I think Ross contractualism is much limited in scope. It is just a political. And the Scanlon's contractualism is more comprehensive in scope, and it discusses nature and scope of morality, etc. So I'm focusing on Ross contractualism here. Yeah, so what kind of Confucianism I'm talking about? Let's move to Confucianism. And Confucian ethics is very rich, and the Confucians, they have very drastically different understanding of human nature. They have different understandings of what morality is and how particular order should be conducted. And I'm focusing on Confucian role ethics, which is one interpretation of Confucian ethics. I'm not saying that, well, this is the only one correct interpretation of Confucian ethics. I'm only saying that, well, this is a very influential understanding of Confucian ethics among many others. There are virtual ethical understandings, there are, you know, deontological understandings, let's say care ethics. But the real ethical account is very solid. And the main concerns of Confucian real ethicists or Confucian communitarians is their dissatisfaction with, you know, the liberal understanding of the self and their as autonomous individuals, and especially the rights talk that liberals promote. And instead, Confucian communitarians or Confucian real ethicists, they put forward three very important arguments. The first argument is that they understand human beings, they start from human beings. They stand from what it means to be human. And then the first argument is that they see humans not as human beings, but as human becomings. So being human is always a process. So Confucians distinguish between animals and humans. And also in terms of being human, they, you know, they have different categorizations of human beings in terms of virtue cultivation. And there are ordinary people, there are petty people, below ordinary people. The petty people, they don't care about morality. And then above ordinary people, there are, you know, shi, and then again, noble persons, and then sages. Sages is the highest level. And the second argument is that roles are essential to an ethical understanding of humans, and they understand people, you know, person playing roles and their relationships as a focus field. And they understand human beings not, they understand humans not as right-bearing individuals, but as role-playing persons. Because roles, kind of the social roles and family roles, the roles as husband, wife, and as parents, children, teacher, student, and the ruler role. So there are a whole bunch of social and political relationships, and the roles one plays deeply structure, you know, what it means to be human. And then, so this is very nicely, so I'm quoting Henry Rosman here, who says that, well, I'm the totality of roles. I live in relation to specific others. And the third argument is that, well, the very conventional Confucian values of benevolence and ritual, they should be understood. So the Confucian value of benevolence should be understood as virtuosity, and Confucian ritual should be understood as concrete guidance, which just sustain and regulate human relationships and how one should play those roles in social relationships. But there are two questions. Well, there are some very fierce critiques of them. And one concern is a lack of agency. So if I'm the totality of roles, then where is the agency for human beings, right? And that's, so just in response to this critique, we can distinguish between a thick understanding of Confucian ethics and a thin understanding of Confucian ethics. And according to the thick understanding, kind of human relationships, humans are constituted and determined by those roles. And then for a thin understanding, roles are just essential. Roles are essential to what it means to be human, but still roles don't determine what it means to be human. Okay. So I think the thin understanding is more plausible, and I will just build on that thin understanding of conditional ethics. And the second concern is that even if we adopt a thin understanding of conditional ethics, still we owe justification to persons if they have moral status, if we are to treat them, you know, as free and equal humans. Because even if, you know, we have a thin understanding of conditional ethics, we still need to justify if the state, let's say, if the state is trying to promote a law, you know, promoting the Confucian value of filial piety, still, you know, the state needs to justify the value of Confucian, the value of filial piety to East Asian citizens. And that is a concern, again, raised by Song Wenqing. So I'm moving towards the tweak the original position part. So I think Confucian law ethics, even a thin understanding of Confucian law ethics, needs to accommodate the key contractarian, you know, concern, which is that, you know, what it means to treat persons as free and equal. And just like Charles Mills, who recently passed away, but he is deeply concerned with, you know, the contractarian approach. But still, Charles Mills thinks that social, we cannot just discard, you know, the social contract altogether, because there is still a deep, you know, sense of treating humans, respecting humans, that liberal idea in the social contract. I'm just trying to appropriate that idea in the Confucian context. So what I'm trying to do is to seek a fusion between Confucian law ethics and Rawls and conceptualist approach. Back to Rawls' original position, I think there are, of course, lots of premises, but there are two premises which I'm going to, you know, work on, or I'm going to, you know, tweak. The first premise is the veil of ignorance. You know, participants in the original position, they should they should be in that position behind the veil of ignorance, which means that they should not deliberate on the basis of factors that are morally relevant, right? And the second premise is that the participants in the original position, they should be mutually disinterested, and they are mutually disinterested rational beings in a divisive representation. It is kind of like trustee relationship, and participants in the original position, they are kind of trustees, and they are kind of deliberating. They are trying to just coming up with, you know, how to best promote the well-being or the rights of, you know, their trustees in the real world. So just like what Charles Mills did, just to, you know, take the original position, I'm also going to, you know, make some changes to the original position. And the first change I'm going to make is that participants in the original position, they should know social roles. So they should know that, well, they're, you know, the people that they are going to take care of in the real world, they are going to play social roles. So they should know that the people are going to be, you know, parents and children, they're going to be friends, they're going to be in you know, lots of social family and political relationships. And the second premise is that, you know, participants in the original position, they should be disinterested, or just that they should have some moral standards, but still they are mutually disinterested. So they are mutually disinterested, and this is the same as Rawls' original position. But still, They need to have some moral standards to make a sound decision. So the key question is, what would the morally competent trustees or shi choose in a device of representation? Sorry, given the roles their trusters are going to play in the real world. So I think there are two principles that can be derived from this strict origin position. And these are two principles that stand in tandem, and there is no priority. They are both very important. They are both, they share the priority. And the first principle is still the principle of basic rights and liberties. But the second principle is that the state should promote virtues and dispositions appropriate to social roles. Of course, they can be in tandem at some point. Because, you know, if respecting basic rights and liberties is a precondition for cultivating virtues. You cannot just impose virtues on a person. But still, they're at some point, they can part company. The two principles can part company. But when they part company, we have to resort to reflective equilibrium, and there is no easy way out. In making this argument, I'm not just making things up. There is some nascent argument in a very prominent 20th century new Confucian, Xu Fuguan's thought. He distinguishes between Xiuji and Zhiren, which is principles applied to self and principles applied to others. His argument is that Confucians should respect, you know, people's rights and liberties, but also Confucians have perfections and concerns. And these are not, you know, just irreconcilable. So I'm just couching, you know, his argument in the language of, you know, Rawlsian contractualism. So I will discuss just briefly to go through some objections. In what sense my approach is still Confucian? It is still Confucian because I preserve Confucian perfection, the concerns, and roles are essential to Confucian ethics. I have made no change to that very basic premise. And in what sense is my approach contractually justificatory? So the participants in the origin position, in the tricked origin position, they are still trying to, you know, they are still behind some way of ignorance, right? They just factor in, you know, social roles, but they don't, you know, deliberate on the basis of those morally arbitrary factors. Then that's the two-stage justification process make a difference. Of course, it makes a difference because in traditional Confucian ethics, there is no, you know, principle of basic rights and liberties. And secondly, the kind of Confucian perfectionist values promoted after adopting Rawlsian contractualism are deeply egalitarian. So let's say in traditional Confucian ethics, the wife should be submissive to the husband, and the Confucian role ethics almost has nothing to say about this kind of submissiveness. This kind of submissiveness is perfectly compatible with Confucian role ethics, traditionally understood. But, you know, after going through this process, because we have kind of these dual commitments, so we have to, you know, promote perfection values, you know, in an egalitarian manner. And the last point is about cultural relativism. I'm not trying to, you know, export confessional ethics to other communities. I'm just talking about, you know, how Confucian communities, insofar as they take roles seriously, how they can legitimately promote Confucian perfection values. And this is what I call the kind of community-based morality. And then in rights-based morality, in liberal societies in the West, then it is a different story. Perhaps we just need to tweak the original position in the way Charles Mills does. Yeah, so that's my presentation. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, I do welcome John Hartgarthof for joining us. Well, immediately I give you the floor. So you were supposed to be the first one, but as you can see, we have to stick to the program timetable. We already started with Darren. Now is your turn. So please, John, you have the floor.
Well, thank you very much. My audio is coming through all right. All right. And it's not necessary, but I've put a URL to a Dropbox link to a handout for anyone who'd like a little bit of content to follow as I speak. And look, so the remarks I'm going to make today are going to be extremely broad. And so in this sense, it's something of an indulgent presentation. I'm not holding myself to the standards of scholarship or argument that one might otherwise hope to see in an academic presentation. But this is because, I mean, it's partly because of the time constraints that we're under, but it's also because I think that it's important for people in the academic world from time to time to step back every now and then and look at the big picture. And obviously there's only so much of that we can do in one session, but this presentation is part of a sort of broader effort of trying to encourage people to take a broader look at things, because there's so many different understandable pressures that lead people to get extremely fine and narrow in what they investigate and think about and write about. Well, so the title of this presentation is Remedying the Empiricist Syndrome, Placing John Rawls in Intellectual History. And so what I want to do is just, with the brief time that I have, is just say a little bit about what do I mean by the empiricist syndrome, because I think that it is a kind of background of ideas that are certainly not endorsed by everyone. Certainly they're subject to criticism of all sorts in different corners, but that I think frame a lot of our conversations, both in academic philosophy and also to some extent in the sort of broader political and social conversations that go on. This is especially true in what you might think of as like mainstream English language philosophy, but I think that it's even true to some extent for traditions that self-consciously define themselves in opposition to that, because it's often the case that if you define yourself in opposition to something, you end up in an unwitting way inheriting some of the unwitting presuppositions of the tradition that you're critiquing. Well, what can I say about this extremely broad topic and what it has to do with Rawls? Well, here's what I mean very briefly by the empiricist syndrome. Like, if you think of, you know, philosophy in general, as this is itself obviously crude, but having sort of four broad topics, namely politics, ethics, epistemology or mind, and metaphysics. Well, we can associate, I think, a particular, you know, ideology or doctrine or orientation with each of these, where in politics it's capitalism, in ethics it's utilitarianism, in epistemology or mind it's empiricism, and in metaphysics or method it's reductionism. And now, it's not that any of these broad, I mean, these broad isms are extremely broad, right? There are many different forms of each of these things, and they don't entail one another or anything like that. But what I'm trying to bring out is that there are broad affinities among these ideas. And I think that they are all extremely misguided as presuppositions for philosophical exploration. And I think that many of them have broad appeal only because of kind of peculiar features of our cultural environment. And I'm not going to try and establish anything like that in the brief remarks that I'm making here today, but I just want to encourage people to take on that question in case it's not the kind of question that you've thought about before. And again, with the idea that there are two different very broad domains within which this question might be significant in the academic context and the non-academic context of political and social discussion. Well, and if to the extent that, so let me just briefly say, why is this a syndrome? Why aren't these just four different things that are prominent in contemporary discussions? Well, let me start with the easiest one, one that Rawls himself discusses in quite illuminatingly, I think, right, which are connections between capitalism and utilitarianism, right? Like, so these doctrines share certain features, an emphasis on what is putatively public and measurable and even quantifiable. They share an emphasis on growth of value as each system of ideas understands it. They share an emphasis on optimization of value as each of them understands it. And they share an emphasis on aggregation as the appropriate response to conflicts of value within the sphere that each applies to. I think these are very deep affinities. And very, you know, very broadly speaking, I think utilitarianism is kind of a preposterous view. And even someone who's often regarded as utilitarian, Joseph Raz, says as much. He says nobody's actually utilitarian, and I kind of think that on some level, because if you think about it, it's an extraordinarily strong claim, right? Like, it's the one making the claim. Like, the claim of utilitarianism is that, or consequentialism more generally actually, is that only one kind of thing is relevant to moral appraisal, namely the outcomes or consequences of an action. That's an extraordinarily strong claim. And when you add to it the fact that there are many effective critiques, including Rawls's, the fact that there really hasn't been an adequate treatment of many crucial topics in ethics by the utilitarian tradition, including, but not limited to, obligation and virtue. It's really not best understood, in my view, as a going concern. But the fact that it is treated as one, even by its critics, is, I think, itself distorting, because it makes it seem as though an important thing to do in ethical theory is to situate one's own work with respect to utilitarianism. And this is certainly true of Rawls. So just to give a broad account of like what, you know, the very broad take here that I'm encouraging, it's not that Rawls is the solution to these problems, but because he is maybe as much as any other single figure responsible for having critiqued each of these four major planks of the empiricist syndrome. And the fact that he is one figure and an extremely deep figure, I think Rawls is a member of the canon and is an extremely important figure. I mean, more significant than certain other canonical figures. And so I think he is a figure, even though I don't endorse a lot of what he says, he's a figure worth taking extremely seriously and worthy of study for the indefinite future. But because he is a deep thinker and because he is a single figure, that you can look to him, I won't try to spell this all out here, but you can look to him for ways of connecting up critiques of each of these four different things, because he did that within one philosopher's perspective on all of this. But I see the appropriate attitude to take towards Rawls being something more like a maieutic role, like a role of midwifing in the proper philosophical methodology, rather than exemplifying it all himself, even though I actually think, given the context within which he was writing, the advances that he made are actually quite extraordinary. Okay, well, what else are the affinities here? Well, the emphasis on putatively public values, is an affinity between capitalism and utilitarianism on the one hand, and empiricism on another, right? Where there's, you know, empiricism is saying, well, look, you know, we can't really trust these reflections. Certainly, it is true that there's a kind of sorry history on the part of, you know, systematic and often dogmatic philosophers, including the sort of exemplary figures of the rationalist tradition. What I'm endorsing is a form of rationalism, but again, that's just because rationalism isn't subject to a narrow definition in the same way that, strictly speaking, empiricism is. Rationalism isn't saying, the fundamental commitment is that human reason is our best arbiter for what to think about things. It's, rationalism itself is not committed to any strong form of foundationalism about justification or anything like that. I mean, sometimes I joke when I'm teaching ethics, I'll say, like, you know, if you start your ethical theory course by saying there's two different kinds of theories, you have consequentialists and non-consequentialists, you know, I regard this as, you know, analogous to starting your course on animal biology by saying there's two kinds of animals, you know, platypuses and non-platypuses or something like that. I mean, it's such a peculiar, it makes sense in a certain way, right, given our cultural milieu, but I think that it doesn't... To me, the interesting question about utilitarianism is to explain away its popularity, not to take it seriously as any philosophical proposal. And again, I won't try and go through it, but, you know, Rawls has alternatives to all of these things. Let me just say also briefly about reductionism, right? Like, so there's a empiricism as a philosophical tradition is obviously strongly associated with reductionism. Empiricism is strongly associated with a kind of skepticism, where, you know, phenomena that are taken seriously by other philosophers are sort of treated as not, not real somehow. Like, and so it's built into all of these aspects of the syndrome, even though some figures take this on and others don't. I think that every one of these things, capitalism, utilitarianism, empiricism, and reductionism, are best understood as they were understood by the sort of most exemplary and in some ways most ridiculous figure here who's Bentham, as a radically revisionary approach, both to culture and politics and to philosophy. Like, if someone wants to stand up for these doctrines, that is the way to do it, I think. I mean, that's the only honest approach to what an empiricist or a utilitarian understanding is. I mean, by the way, you know, I said that, you know, Raz says that nobody actually is utilitarian. You know, Chomsky, of course, isn't an empiricist, but he makes the same comment, right? He says nobody's actually an empiricist, and I think he's exactly right about that. Like, if you actually think about what the doctrine says, it's not to be taken seriously, which is not to say, of course, that there aren't things to be learned from these traditions and drawn from these traditions. I'm not at all saying that. And, you know, with Rawls, we get a whole constellation of responses to these things, property owning democracy as opposed to capitalism, Kantian constructivism as opposed to utilitarianism, the sort of broadly Rousseauian developmental psychology of chapter 8 of Theory of Justice as opposed to an empiricist philosophy of mind. And we have this kind of broadly Wittgensteinian practice basis, you know, that's deep in Rawls's methodology. By the way, his presidential address to the APA is exemplary in this respect, the independence of moral theory as a statement of Rawls's method in a way that is very self-consciously opposed to the reductionism that was utterly prevalent in the mid-20th century in English language philosophy. And now again, like, I'm covering so much ground, so I hope you'll forgive that. But I think that, by the way, I should add this too, right? You know, there's the famous line from Nietzsche that man does not pursue happiness, only the Englishman does that. I think he could have added to that, and we're all going to be Englishmen soon, right? Because I think that the root, you know, basis of the appeal is the sort of overweening influence of capitalism in shaping the culture of most, you know, earliest of the English language world. But of course, the influence is increasingly pervasive across various cultural divides. Now, you know, all right, let me make another reference here, which is to what I regard as maybe the best work of ethical theory published in the last 10 or 15 years, which is Tal Brewer's book, The Retrieval of Ethics. And the introduction to that book has some very provocative comments where he says, the history of ethics can be seen as the story of progress only if it is read in reverse. And then he follows this up by saying, to some extent, recent developments are an exception to this. And he talks about how, again, he doesn't say much about Rawls, but, you know, largely under Rawls's influence. I mean, there were other important figures like Bernard Williams and many others, but, you know, Alistair MacIntyre and Elizabeth Anscombe, there are many figures that were part of this. But partly under Rawls's influence, there was a resurgence of interest in the 70s and forward in neo-Kantian ethics. There was a resurgence of interest under the influence of Anscombe and others in the 80s on neo-Aristotelian ethics. And then by the late 90s, you have a revival of interest in some really, in basically Platonistic, you know, accounts. And so in a way, like I'm mentioning that Brewer mentions all of this just to say, part of what the plea here is, is for philosophers to recognize those strands, which are by no means dominant, but they are much, much more prominent than they were in the middle part of the 20th century. And this is part of the salutary effect of folks like Rawls on the academic philosophy, is to see it that way and to see us as reclaiming or retrieving things that were lost because of the influence of what I'm labeling the empiricist syndrome. And so, you know, I have to go quickly here, but, you know, with Rawls, like, so there's an affinity with the empiricist syndrome and meritocracy as well, that I think it runs very deeply. And it is a great merit of Rawls's work that it is, in that is often missed, and people who don't read Rawls carefully or get what, you know, hear about him only secondhand are often are very surprised to learn that he is both an anti-meritocratic and an anti-capitalist thinker explicitly, right, in the text. Like, these are not matters of interpretation. And this is partly because there is, as I indicated on the handout, I think a kind of understandable crisis in liberal political thought right now that's driven partly by the fact that people from all directions are, for some good reason, heaping scorn on culturally dominant modes of liberalism in the present day. And I'm fine with that in a certain sense. It's just that I think that it's super important when we're trying to mount a critique of all of that, either in an academic sense or in a broader context, that we need to be able to recover what is absolutely vital about the liberal tradition with whatever, future ideals that we put forward. And so it's actually kind of helpful in a way that Rawls is so often so unfairly maligned, I think, as being an apologist for meritocracy or capitalism or anything, something like that, that you can actually use the texts themselves to show how what some of the people who are legitimately criticized for advancing what I anyway would regard as, whether they know it or not, a kind of retrogressive form of liberalism in the current cultural context, many of those people would be happy to say that Rawls is like the sophisticated philosophical spokesperson for their own view. And so there's a kind of rhetorical benefit in the fact that you can say, well, okay, let's look at what he actually had to say and how it might be developed in future work. And so the emphasis on an anti-meritocratic social equality, the emphasis on, you know, social measures of value as opposed to subjective welfare as the measure of value, the emphasis on the constitution of social relationships as opposed to growth and outcome orientation, which is quite prominent in liberal or neoliberal thought. And of course, the emphasis on attention to the least advantage when we're talking about how to manage conflict, as contrasted with an emphasis on aggregation as a method of managing conflicts of interest. Now, but as I intimated before, I think that this is all extremely salutary and again, kind of remarkable given the milieu in which Rawls was himself writing. But I think it needs to be extended. We need to go farther. And I want to just say a few words about what I have in mind by that. So one of the most important things that I think is a virtue of Rawls's writing is his emphasis on the wisdom encoded in practices. Now, I don't endorse a kind of Wittgensteinism in general, but I certainly think that there's something absolutely correct about the importance of, especially in ethics and politics, attending to wisdom that is encoded in the actual practices that we have. Because in the empiricist tradition's general failure to do this is part of what accounts for, it's not just making philosophical mistakes, everybody does that, but with having a really, I think, kind of implausible and to some extent pernicious set of ideologies. And in particular, Rawls pays attention to the fact that concern for the dignity of individuals is encoded in our social practices. Now, of course, he takes pains to present this in a way that for his political purposes, he's only talking about this as a presupposition of democratic societies and so forth. But whether we endorse that part of Rawls or not, he is doing the thing of bringing out the ways in which there are actual social and political practices that are encoding wisdom about this. And this involves a resistance to sort of vulgar deflations and revisions and so forth of existing social practices. And also he aspired, he doesn't say this a lot in his published works, but in his letters and things, you know, my colleague David Reedy, by the way, is you know, currently writing an intellectual biography of Rawls, and he got access to all of the materials, and so he kind of jealously guards all of the best anecdotes and so forth, but I have some access to this via him. And it's very clear from Rawls's personal writings that he regarded himself as trying to present a political philosophy that was genuinely scientific in spirit, even though it wasn't empiricist in any narrow sense. I'm not actually aware of how Rawls self-identified. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't throw down on either side of any empiricist-rationalist dispute. The place that I'm aware of where he most explicitly discusses it is in Chapter 8 of Theory of Justice, where he presents himself as a synthesis of the true traditions. But it's clear that to my mind anyway, in interpreting him, that the rationalist part is driving the train, because he's accepting the sort of broad presuppositions of folks like Rousseau and Piaget and Kohlberg, and he's fitting the insights of folks like Hume and so forth within the framework where the Rousseauvian rationalist psychology is the overarching frame. And I think it's appropriate that we think of it this way. Like, how do we have something that's genuinely scientific, not in the sense that it's empirical science, but in the sense that it's genuinely scientific in spirit, as opposed to empiricism, which I regard as primarily faux science. And I actually think this is an enormous part of the appeal of the view of empiricism, is that it sounds like it's science, like it's scientific. But in point of fact, there's nothing about the actual practice of science that in any way, shape, or form entails empiricism. In fact, I think that, you know, I can't try to substantiate this here, but I actually think that the practices of science suggest quite the opposite from that. And now this is not itself a convincing argument, but just to try and destabilize those of you who may have in your mind, understandably, a strong association between empiricism and scientific respectability, it's worth noting that the pioneering figures of modern science were almost uniformly rationalists, right? During the same era when rationalism versus empiricism in the 17th century was prominent in people's minds. I mean, I know that that's partly a retrospective interpretation, but they, people were aware of this, you know, at the time as well. And who were these figures? You know, we're talking about Descartes, we're talking about Leibniz, we're talking about Newton, all of whom were rationalists. And almost none of the major empiricist figures from the 17th and 18th century were accomplished scientists. Hume wasn't, Hobbes wasn't. Hobbes had an enormous chip on his shoulder about the fact that the Royal Society wouldn't let him in, right? And I think this is not a coincidence. I mean, Berkeley is maybe an exception. He was an accomplished scientist despite being a member of the empiricist tradition, but of course he's also probably the least significant of the major empiricist figures of the era, so I'm not sure what lesson to draw from that. And anyway, the point isn't that we have to accept the interpretations of people from the 17th or 18th century about what science is. It's just to sort of shake loose, like that there is this ideology that empiricism is somehow scientifically respectable that needs, at a minimum, needs defense. I mean, I don't think it's remotely plausible. And by the way, for those who are interested in this, the corpus of Tyler Burge is exceptional in this. And so, and he is in certain respects self-consciously building on insights that were only very briefly articulated by Saul Kripke in Naming Necessity. And I think that there's something very important about what was going on in the world of English language philosophy in the early 70s, like 1970, basically. 1970 is when the Naming Necessity lectures were delivered, and it's when the original manuscript of Theory of Justice was completed. You know, they were published in 71 and 72, but 70 is when both of those things were completed. And I think that there are important strands that can be carried through these two traditions that are very widely divergent, right, in the literatures that followed and picked up on them. Kripke doesn't develop his methodological insights nearly as fully as Rawls does. And Burge, I think, who has views that differ from Kripke's in certain other respects, but he has developed a methodology that is very fully articulated in various places, including his book, Origins of Objectivity. It's mostly about perception, but there are lessons for all other areas of philosophy therein. So just to try and tie this all together, it's such a broad set of comments. I hope that, again, that you'll forgive that. But let me just say, what do we need that's beyond Rawls here, right? Well, one thing that Rawls doesn't do in his core topic, right, which is political philosophy, is he doesn't actually foreground labor power. He's clearly sensitive to the need for it, But his frame for diagnosing and recommending revision to prevailing injustices does not focus on structures of power. And I think that this means that Rawls, even though I think he's extremely important as a critic of capitalism, especially, but also of utilitarianism and empiricism and reductionism, it's important that he be supplemented, right, with a work that is probably familiar to many of you, that there's a whole any number of figures, right, who work explicitly on power relations. And I think that the broad orientation that I'm recommending in political philosophy is just a synthesis of these things, a fusion of these things. I mean, very crudely or roughly, you could think of it as a fusion of the liberal and socialist traditions. I think that's fine as long as you're taking the best of each. But anyway, you know, regardless of the labels and the isms, I think we need an articulation of ideals that, you know, the best version of which has been articulated by Rawls to be conjoined with in a complementary spirit, not a competitive spirit. There may be some conflicts that need to be worked out, but that's just how syntheses work, right? With an account of labor power. In ethics, again, I'll just say briefly, I can't substantiate this. I think this is going beyond Rawls. A realism that's grounded in the status value of individuals. Like, I mean, this is something that's emphasized in certain parts of the work of David Bellman, for example. But it's too much to try and say more about this. But emphasizing and developing a theory of, this is very underdone in contemporary philosophy, a theory of the value of individuals themselves, as opposed to the value of what's good for them or what the value of their excellence is. I think we need a full-throated rationalism in the spirit of Tyler Burge. And I think that in metaphysics or methodology, we actually need to go beyond the sort of broad pragmatism of folks like Wittgenstein and Rawls. That what we should have is a straightforward realism about science and about the claims that we're attempting to make in ethics and politics, but with a very deeply felt fallibilism and incompleteness. Like, this is part of where figures like Kripke and Burge, I think, do a little bit better than Rawls, although I think he's aware of it, but he doesn't talk about it explicitly. Kripke and Burge are extremely mindful of the fallibilism and incompleteness of the views that they put forward. And I think that if we take that kind of modesty very deeply in our philosophical methodologies, it may turn out that any ism of, you know, pragmatism is no more necessary than the isms of reductionism or empiricism in order to talk good sense. And I have to say, by the way, just as a kind of last shot at empiricism too, it's worth noting there's a deep false modesty involved in empiricism. And this is true of utilitarianism as well, right? Where the traditions present themselves as saying, look, I'm not saying all that wild stuff that the rationalist is saying about what's true. I don't, you know, or what's valuable. I don't know about all that. I'm just sticking with you know, what I know. But then at the output end, you get extremely revisionist claims, right? You know, I mean, what, like, you get, you know, anyway, I mean, we'll just read, you know, J.G.C. Smart or W.V. O'Quine if you want to know the lengths to which folks will go in these traditions. And they're the honest ones, right? Like, they're the ones who are actually developing these, the ideas as they would be in their full development. So just to wrap up, I'll just say, I think there is a kind of crisis in liberal culture. I self-identify as a liberal, even though I hesitate to do so, because, like, I'm more comfortable doing so in an academic context than in a broader context because of what the, you know, the label has come to mean. But regardless of whether we call ourselves liberals, I think it's absolutely important to mine the liberal tradition, and Rawls in particular, both so that we, for resources for this broad reorientation that I think is needed in academic philosophy, and for the very urgent conversations that need to take place about how to critique neoliberalism and articulate visions of going forward from here. So anyway, thanks very much for listening to that take. I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, thank you very much, John. Beth, I give you the floor. This is your time.
All right, I will share my screen. Okay, can you all see that? Okay, so, hi, my name is Beth. I am in North Carolina right now in the US, and it is 9:30 in the morning here. So I am talking today about roles and what I see as one of the kind of most important issues about distributive justice and humanitarianism going on in the world right now, which is COVID-19 vaccine distribution. So I'm looking at this paper, which is kind of tentatively called Rawls, Statism, and the Justice of Global COVID-19 Vaccine Distribution. So my basic thesis is that this idea that COVID-19 vaccine distribution between nations is somehow morally optional or humanitarian in nature, that it isn't about distributive justice or obligation, that it's about superirrigation and optional morality. So what I am focusing on is Rawls's Law of Peoples. And what I'm going to do is say that Rawls's Law of Peoples seemingly provides justification for the way that the kind of international relation of COVID-19 vaccination is being distributed. But I think there are two problems with using Rawls in this way. First, it highlights a problem that is often pointed out in Rawls's Law of Peoples, which is that it highlights this issue of primarily national as opposed to international decisions that are supposed to pervasively impact the lives of a citizen. And secondly, what I'm going to say is, what if we grant it? What if we grant everything that Rawls says in Law of Peoples and how COVID-19 vaccine distribution ought to work? I think even if that's true, given the nature of this particular virus, the idea of statism and this nation-first approach to vaccine distribution is still problematic because it's not the way to actually end this pandemic. So even if we did have this kind of nation-first approach, we would still have to think globally as opposed to nationally. So this is the kind of basic thesis that I'm going to be looking at. I'm going to unpack it in three different parts. I'm going to talk about some background to what COVID-19 vaccines look like right now. I'm going to then talk about Rawlsian statism and his notion of global humanitarianism. And then I'm going to grant statism and point out the issues with using this approach, even if we assume that Rawls was correct. So first off, some COVID vaccine distribution issues. So I am, like I said, here in the United States. A lot of this will be perspectives of the United States. But as many of us already know, the COVID-19 vaccines have been generally stockpiled and hoarded by higher income nations. So before these vaccines even came out, many of the wealthier nations already bought them and bought more than would ever be needed by the citizens of those actual countries, right? So they're stockpiling in this way. And by doing this, we have this really interesting result, which is that lower income nations, which may not have been able to afford vaccines in the first place, don't have access to them. But also middle income nations, which would have been able to afford vaccines, could not because they were already bought, pre-ordered, and stockpiled by wealthier nations. So we see this really distorted view of how these are being distributed. In addition, especially in the US, there's this big discussion of booster shots right now. Actually, the Moderna shot was just granted booster status last night, this morning. So the issue here is with people that are healthy generally and have no pre-existing conditions, should they get boosters to the vaccines they've already gotten before many people in the rest of the world have even gotten their first shot? So this is often the discussion that's being had. And then we have COVAX, which we'll talk about just a little bit. This is the organization that has been created to try to increase equity globally in terms of COVID-19 vaccines. So this is a statement from COVAX, kind of describing what it is. COVAX is co-led by the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, Gavi, and the World Health Organization, alongside key delivery partner UNICEF. Its aim is to accelerate the development and manufacture of COVID-19 vaccines and to guarantee fair and equitable access for every country in the world. So I won't go into it here, but we can talk about it in the Q&A if you want, about the successes or failures of COVAX. They have recently said that they are actually going to lower the estimate of how many vaccines they're going to distribute by the end of this year pretty significantly. So there have been some pretty serious problems with COVAX, but this is the kind of main goal. So looking at some of the basic distributions of vaccines, this is UN data at the end of September. So as you can see in the purple, we have higher income nations and access to vaccines. We have upper middle income in the blue. In the pink, we have lower middle income. And then the very kind of thin red line at the bottom is lower income nations in their access to vaccines. So as we can see, higher income nations, about one in two people or 61% of the population has at least one dose. Whereas in lower income countries, one in 28 people, which is only about 3.5% of the populations, have had at least one dose. And in terms of how this is being distributed around the world, we can see exactly what parts of the world have access and what parts of the world do not. So the dark green has higher administrative doses all the way down to red, which has the lowest amount. So as we can see, this gets clustered in certain areas of the world, especially depending on things like GDP, whether these nations bought these doses in advance, how they have had access to them or lack of access to them. So what COVAX has said, and this is, I think, important for us to kind of think about when we turn to Rawls and this Rawlsian idea. So one statement from the WHO about COVAX: as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to claim lives, destroy livelihoods, and stunt economic recovery, we continue to emphasize that no one is safe until everyone is safe. There's only one way to end the pandemic and prevent the emergence of new and stubborn variants, and that is by working together. So we have this very clear message, this no one is safe until everyone is safe, and that this is something that the world has to do together, versus this very kind of nation-centered approach. This is the way we've actually approached how vaccines are distributed. So let's look at this. In this section, I'm going to talk about Rawls, Rawlsian statism, and this notion of humanitarianism. So when you look at the language of COVAX, if you just Google COVAX and look at the news headlines, you see this very distinct language that takes on humanitarian terminology. So donating vaccines, sharing vaccines, committing support to donate vaccines, pledging to donate vaccines. There will be a news headline in the US about, President Biden has vowed to share X number of vaccine doses with the rest of the world. And this language implies that it is kind of supererogatory and morally voluntary, that this is a good thing for a nation to do, though not required. It is good. Look at what wealthy nations are doing to help others. This is this kind of basic kind of humanitarian language, like we would see after a kind of climate event or something like that. So why this language? Why is the world kind of assumed, largely speaking, that this is the kind of language that we're using? So I think a lot of the foundation can be found in Rawls. So in Rawls's Law of Peoples, so I won't go into this too much since this is the whole conference on Rawls and people probably know the basics already, but the Law of Peoples, what Rawls wrote much later in life, is where he discusses what the kind of global implications are for justice. So until Law of Peoples came out, people thought, after a theory of justice, that this kind of justice as fairness that applied within closed societies would apply globally, that there would be some sort of global original position, and that just like how individuals wouldn't know within their closed society who they were going to be on the other side, people wouldn't know what nationality they were going to be, where in the world they were going to be, and so on and so forth. So most kind of early discussions of this, so Bites, Fogey, et cetera, they assumed that that was the stance that Rawls was going to take. And then, of course, in Law of Peoples, that is very much not the stance that Rawls ended up taking. So instead, in Rawls's Law of Peoples, he gives the Law of Peoples. That's eight different principles that are supposed to kind of govern how nations, or what he calls peoples, interact with each other. Side note, not going to talk about peoples. Most people don't. This was Rawls's terminology. was important to him because it's about this issue of self-interest and beneficence between peoples, but I'm just going to say nations or countries or peoples interchangeably. It's really, it's not important for purposes, but that's why this people's language is in there. So the eight principles in the law of peoples really kind of read like just war theory, treaties between nations, how to govern agreements, trade, et cetera, et cetera. It's nothing like justice is fairness on a global scale. So the eighth principle is the one that's most important for my purposes. And this one reads, peoples have a duty to assist other peoples living under unfavorable conditions that prevent their having a just or decent political social regime. So without getting into the weeds too much about law of peoples, Rawls's main idea was that the world to be just is not equal states. It's not equal countries, equal peoples in terms of resources. There can be pretty vast inequalities, actually. The issue is that they are all internally well-ordered. So we're looking for well-ordered states that have well-ordered basic structures. Nations that are not well-ordered, he has a whole list of different kinds of nations that aren't well-ordered. The ones that matter for us are burdened nations, or burdened peoples. And these are peoples that aren't able to organize their basic structure, largely because of things like poverty. So the obligation of wealthier nations towards those nations who aren't well-ordered because of things like poverty is humanitarianism, is not global distributed justice. So humanitarianism, this idea of a duty to assist, Rawls emphasizes has a cutoff point. It has a target of helping nations get well-ordered. It's not about fairly or equitably distributing resources between nations. There is no equivalent to distributive justice, to Maxi-Men, to the difference principle on the global scale. So the goal here is to have global justice that has internally well-ordered peoples. If there are inequalities in things like wealth, various other resources, welfare, well-being, primary goods, what have you. If there's these kind of inequalities, that's not an issue on the global scale, unless there's extreme inequality to the point where there are such power differentials that they can't even negotiate treaties between each other, or that it undermines the ability of a nation to have a well-structured basic structure. But for Rawls, that's going to be really rare. He doesn't really think that inequality takes that kind of form. So this is the language that I think is used in when we talk about COVAX, when we talk about global vaccine distribution. It's humanitarianism. It's not about global distributed justice. So we're not talking generally, the WHO might be, right? But individual nations are often not talking about how it is a moral failure or a failure of justice on their part that they ensure that their own citizens receive equitable distributions of vaccines before being concerned about distributions of vaccines outside of nations. Instead, just like Rawls, what we're concerned about within a nation is global distributive justice. What we're concerned about outside of that nation is humanitarianism, is beneficence after we've already completed this kind of distributed justice within a nation. So this is this kind of nation-first approach that you see with COVAX, that a fair distribution of vaccines nationally is more important than being concerned about some sort of international distribution. So I think that we can use this language to try to figure out why we have this terminology when we talk about vaccine distribution. And one of the most important things I think that comes out of this is a very common objection to the law of peoples, which is, of course, this idea of pervasive impact. So Rawls kind of infamously said that the wealth and stability of a nation is primarily dependent upon its own people, not any sort of international interaction. So it's about how hardworking, about the virtues and ethos of a people are. That's how well the nation does, as opposed to how nations interact with each other, impacting how someone's life goes. Now, I say primarily dependent. There's debate here about whether Rawls thinks that international interaction really has no bearing whatsoever on pervasive impact for individuals. I think that's kind of uncharitable. That just seems so empirically false. So I assume that Rawls means that it's primarily dependent on its own people, that there is, there has to be some sort of international interaction that matters. But so this is me being charitable to Rawls here. The idea here is that the basic structure of a nation has pervasive impact on the individuals of that nation. So my life and how it goes is largely dependent on the United States, on the laws, on the rules that I follow, on the social cooperation that has been created, and so on and so forth. Because of this, I have a kind of right to distributive justice from this nation. So if you think about it in a cooperative approach, that the benefits that are created within the US in our basic structure of social cooperation ought to be fairly distributed. Or in a, if you take a coercive way of looking at it, I am kind of subject to the laws and coercion of this government, therefore I am owed fair distributions by that same government. However you want to parse that out, this is on a national stage, not an international stage. Now, many people have critiqued this since it came out, right? The idea that this just seems empirically false. Maybe a lot of our lives do depend on how well our nation is structured, but how our nation is structured often has, as a result, and it has impact on how the rest of the world is structured. So it seems pretty infeasible to try to distinguish international versus national factors. This kind of ignores the history of how a country came about, its past interactions with people. It ignores a lot of other things, even just currently, like how trade practices work, which we see with COVID vaccines. It ignores things like global governing bodies, the UN, other kind of regulations, the WHO, the WTO. It ignores things like immigration, the fact that the borders and regulations of other nations impact how I am able to travel or live. So many, many people have written on these kinds of problems. Now, I have written previously about how I think Rawls can actually respond to some of these. Not that I think he's particularly right about this, but I think there could be responses, but not all of them. And I think this COVID vaccine is another example of something that Rawls really just can't effectively dispute, which is we're seeing this kind of hoarding on a level that is pretty fascinating to watch in real time. And usually when we talk about the Rawls primary goods and the distribution of primary goods, but however we want to talk about this, resources, welfare, what have you, this kind of hoarding and the very clear ability to see that there are many vaccines, a country like the US has exponentially more vaccines than it needs for its people. But because of this hoarding, because of this pre-buying, and because of various trade barriers, these vaccines have ended up in certain places and not other places. And like we saw with lower income nations that could not afford these vaccines, even middle income nations that could afford these vaccines did not have access to them, especially early on, because of the way that the vaccines were bought. So what we see here is a very obvious example of how the international interaction between nations has pervasively impacted the lives of individuals within nations. So we see how this kind of pervasive impact idea is already kind of problematic in this kind of way. So from here, I have one more important thing to note, which is, okay, well, what if we ignore all that? What if we just grant that statism is the case? What if we grant that we have this nation-first approach and that that is how vaccines ought to be distributed? I think that what we've seen with the COVID-19 virus is that this can't possibly be how it works, even if we assume that Rawls is right, that we have global humanitarianism and distributed justice within nations. So what if we just granted statism here? And we said that before vaccinating anyone else in the world or allocating any of those other vaccines, we have to vaccinate our own people. Well, what we've seen with this virus in particular is that global mutations affect the efficacy of vaccines overall. So when I first submitted this abstract months ago, this was a hypothetical. And now it has come to pass, right? So when I first submitted this, this abstract, I was kind of concerned about this idea that I was hearing in the news that there could be mutations, even if you're vaccinated in a, say, wealthier nation, that other nations are not going to have the same access. If the virus percolates in other areas, it will mutate, and that can kind of thwart the vaccine. And now, a couple months later, we have Delta, and that's exactly what happened. So thank you, COVID-19, for making my point for me here, which is this kind of blurring of national and international impact and interest really shows up in this vaccine. That just like COVAX said, nobody is safe till everybody is safe. Even if we want to focus, even if we said all that matters is the well-being of people within our nation, there still shows a clear problem with the stockpiling notion, because that could end up impacting people even in wealthier nations. So even if you wanted to dismiss everything I've said so far and take a Rawlsian view, take this humanitarian view as opposed to distributed justice view, we see this serious problem with this nation first approach. So just to wrap up, basically, I think the law of peoples can be used as this kind of justificatory framework for COVID-19 vaccine distribution. But we highlight here how it's empirically false that international interactions don't pervasively impact the lives of individuals. And even if we granted this kind of statism, even if we had this idea that justice entails intranational instead of international vaccine distribution, the nature of the virus shows that this can't be the way that we think about it if we want to actually end this pandemic. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Beth. Wonderful presentations. Now we have a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes at most, for discussion. So if any of the attendees wish to put a question, they can make use of this question and answer option in their computers. I don't see any. But I will break the glass by putting a question to each of the panelists. Since we have only a quarter of an hour, I beg you to be brief in your answers and simply kind of draw what an answer to my question would be. To Darren, I'd like to put the following question. By listening to you, while I was listening to you, I thought, look, Rawls might view and be listening to this scholar, Darren, but think by himself, this is a wonderful exercise of how a comprehensive doctrine, in this case, he might even think a comprehensive cultural incorporation of a doctrine fits from its own reasons together with the principles of justice that I might justify. So what would you say if one might answer that to you? For example, one might say to you, I don't know whether this approach you are trying to make between Confucianism and Rawls theory is taken not as much as a loyal fusion of Confucianism and Rawlsianism, but as a good example of what Rawls was already encouraging to do to those different reasonable comprehensive doctrines to come to terms with the first principles of justice and the core, the normative core of his theory. That one might have had, I had at some point that impression. It might not be your intention, but one might say, look, this fits quite well with actually one of Rawls' intention in his political liberalism doctrine, not as much as with his theory of justice doctrine. To a question to John. Well, while I was reading your the the draft you send us, I was wondering whether you consider the possibility of some crossing. I mean, you put on the right, on the left, for example, on the left, the all the items that help in, help us to identify what you mean by the empiricist syndrome. But I am not sure whether all these are coherent or coherent enough. I don't know whether you could develop further, because I have some doubts whether that is correct or not, but I don't see, or I would say that there might be some problems between with respect to the link you seem to draw between the empiricist approach, when the empiricist approach in a sense implies utilitarianism or is close to utilitarianism, and the meritocratic technocracy. Why is it so that utilitarianism and the meritocratic technocracy call each other, in the sense that one might say, well, one can think of, for example, Hare, Richard Merwin Hare, one of the last, let's put it this way, systematic utilitarians, and he was so Kantian-driven, Russian, so he tried to approach utilitarianism not to the empiricist tradition, but to the rationalist approach that one might find in Kant. So one might say utilitarianism is not at all one dimension ethical theory, but it is full of nuances. And so in Hare's terms, I think he would say, look, I'm not defending a meritocratic technocracy, right? Rather the contrary. So what would you, there are difficulties. I know you presented a very broad approach, and this is a long story, but that simply as a possible problem. And then finally, for a question for Beth, I think you didn't consider the possibility of taking the pandemia problems and the vaccine distribution problems into account within the Rawlsian panorama, the Rawlsian theory, by saying, look, there is a clear division of labor between ideal theory and non-ideal theory in Rawls. So one might say, what you said so far applies to what? To ideal or non-ideal conditions, because that makes a big difference. I mean, what he asserts with respect to the eight principles of international justice applies under conditions of ideal theory, when ideal theory is in place. Whereas it might be that this pandemic problem of distribution of these goods, the vaccine, should be approached and tackled by thinking that this is better approach, better tackled through a non-ideal approach. Well, I leave the questions here. Please, we will follow the same order. So Darren, John, Beth.
Yeah, thank you, John, for this wonderful question. I will be brief. I will not say, well, Confucianism is a comprehensive doctrine, because I'm not putting Confucianism in that Ross public reason framework. So I think the distinction between comprehensive and political doctrines, that divide and that distinction is premised on, as I said in my presentation, the priority of the right over the good. And then so comprehensive doctrines are just those values that can only be promoted on condition that you respect the basic rights and liberties first. And then, so I'm not applying Confucianism into that framework. That's what I call the one process model. So what I'm doing is just to parallel what Charles Mills does in his racial justice, and says, well, let's tweak the original position. Well, because Rawlsian contractual reason is plausible, but we should let participants in the original position informed of racial injustice, informed of racial issues. And let's see like what kind of basic principles can be derived from that. And those principles are drastically different from Roth's original two principles. So just like that, so I'm doing this, I'm kind of tweaking, you know, what participants know in the original position in the Confucian context and see what kind of principles can be derived from that. So perhaps Rawls may speak of Confucian as comprehensive doctrines, but still this doesn't, so I'm not using his public reason model, but I'm just borrowing his idea of the original position into the Confucian context in that two-stage model. Thank you.
Yes. Thanks also for the question you posed to me. I mean, maybe just say this, in a way, what I want to do is try and turn the question on its head, right? I mean, there is this tradition in Britain of, you know, reading Kant as a rule utilitarian, which is, I think, interpretively kind of preposterous. And, you know, I think Hare's view is a little bit more interesting, but there are, of course, a whole wide array of indirect utilitarian views. And I'm certainly not, the point of this is by no means supposed to be everyone disregard all the utilitarians. That's not meant to be the lesson. I mean, for that matter, we could talk about Mill, right? Who's clearly, you know, he's avowing empiricism, but bringing in these elements that have a more natural home in the rationalist tradition. But for that reason, it's very questionable whether the view that emerges is coherent. And so in a way, I see this as indirect kind of evidence for the broad claim. And so in this respect, I really appreciate the question, because I think only someone who is under the influence of a not fully conscious ideology, I think, would claim that Kant was a really utilitarian, first of all. But I'm not so much worried about the historical interpretation. But for the more substantive philosophical issue, I think would think that you could give a adequate accounting of, say, the value of a human being in terms of indirect, claims about rules or other things that are indirectly related to consequences. It's not the right kind of value to underwrite the thing that I think is the linchpin value of all of ethics, not exclusively human beings, but conscious beings, the value that they have as individuals, not as opposed to the value they have in their welfare. And so I should, as a final, part of my reply, just say, and here I am parting ways with Rawls, or at least early Rawls, right? Because I think that this very same problem, like in Rawls's very earliest writings from the 50s, you know, he has quite a lot of affinity with utilitarianism, and in Two Concepts of Rules, he takes people to task for critiquing, you know, indirect utilitarianism on the grounds that the ultimate value that's posited doesn't stand in the right relation to the thing that's, you know, being put forward as the thing we're supposed to actually be thinking about when making decisions. And I think Rawls is mistaken about this. Like, I think that we need, like, it's true that these have to be pulled apart, and we have to think carefully about the different roles for different aspects of an overall ethical theory. And so that itself is a helpful thing to say. But I think that there's something very peculiar about consequentialism, where the value that it's appealing to of its nature cannot, regardless of what bells and whistles we put in, account for things that have a very different sort of value, including conscious individuals, and for that matter, I think virtues. And so anyway, I mean, obviously there's a much longer conversation to be had, but in a way, so again, I view figures like Hare and Mill as in a certain sense tragic, because they're insightful people, and they're forcing their insights into, you know, one of the least insightful frameworks through which they might have developed them.
Right. And thank you. Yes, thank you for your question. And I can be brief here as well. So I don't think Rawls knows by the time we hit Law of Peoples, this real distinction between ideal and non-ideal and where he's falling. So I think ideal and non-ideal theory is parsed out very kind of distinctly, especially like in a theory of justice. But by the time he hits Law of Peoples, a lot of Law of Peoples is non-ideal theory. And he says that it is. It's about war. It's about poverty. It's about historic injustices. And he says, given that, still just humanitarianism. So I think that the pandemic, although non-ideal, and maybe we want to say like even more non-ideal than normal non-ideal, is still, I think, going to fall within the parameters of humanitarianism and not global distributed justice. Now, some people disagree with me. There are, Samuel Freeman famously argues that basically maybe there is some global distributed justice if it's very non-ideal, but many people kind of argue against that, and I think they're right. I don't think there's any justification in the text that Rawls actually, I think we want him to say that, but I don't think there's much justification that Rawls actually says that in the text. So unfortunately, although I agree that this is extra non-ideal, I think it still applies in the same way as he has for his kind of normal eight principles in the theory of justice. In law of peoples.
Okay, then. Thank you. Thank you very much for sticking to the timetable, to what we had agreed. It is a pity that you are not here, that we can shake hands and share some relief from our hectic lives after this symposium. Hopefully we will meet again in another venue somewhere else. Thank you very much for taking part in this symposium. So see you around, to you and all the people who attended.
Yeah, thank you for chairing, and thanks.
Thank you so much.
I enjoyed your presentations as well.
Thank you.
Thank you for hosting. Yeah. Thank you. Bye.